This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get. Except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN Game Scoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week is Justin Davis,
Scoop,
Tina Amini, and Sam Claiborne.
Hey, everybody.
Tina, are you still there? I didn't hear you say hi.
Aw, can you not hear me?
Now we can hear you.
Hi, everyone.
It was a little bit clipped, but...
Hello. We've got a great show for you today. A little bit of a slow week, but that just means we have more time for your emails. So we've got lots of good emails from you guys this week. Why is that funny?
I was thinking my week, and like my entire week was emails and Slack messages and stuff. I don't have more time
for it. Emails, no. Not better emails.
It's been a very busy week at IGN. But there's just not as much video game news happening this week. Everyone's taking the Memorial Day week, long weekend off, I guess.
Right.
But let's begin with what we're playing. And I am in Chapter 12 of Final Fantasy VII Remake. Still enjoying it. Still plan to keep playing it. From what I've played so far, I haven't finished the game, but I am over halfway through. From what I've played so far, Tom's score of an 8 seems about right to me.
That's about what's chapter 12 again.
Oh man, they got to stop. Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but they're back in Sector 7 and trying to stop a disaster from happening.
They're climbing the thing.
Yeah.
Really mm-hmm. high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Damon, what did you think of Wall Market and that whole section?
Well, so I wanted to bring that up because you said that was the best part of the game.
Yeah, I think so.
And I thought it was, you know, cool, but it didn't really stick out to me. When I got there, I wasn't like, oh my God, Justin was right. This is amazing.
Yeah, I was curious about that too. Did you guys like the arena or what was it about that people like?
Well, it's an iconic part of the original game that I think people were really excited to see remade. And it's sort of the game at its silliest, you know, with all the climax of how that section of the game ends. And it's so over the top. And I think Wall Market itself is just very atmospheric. And I love how it's all just twisting alleys and like, you know, it's deliberately designed to confuse you and make you lost and all the back alleys. And I really, really loved it. And it was like exactly what littler me pictured in my mind when I played the original game, but sort of blown up into HD. And I just thought they really did a really good job recreating that atmosphere.
Okay.
Yeah. Felt like they made some of the side quests harder to actually navigate in that area. Mm. Like in the slums, when you're first like trying to chase down cats and kids and whatnot, which seems to be a recurring theme, they actually highlight it on your map. They show you like UI of where you're supposed to go, but in Wall Market, it's totally different. You have to kind of contextually go through stuff. / lookup guides, which I may have done. IGN.com.
IGN.com has good guides. Good game help.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was cool. And I do like how
At first, you feel like you're getting lost within Walmart, but then by the time you leave, I feel like I know my way around and I can get where I want to go. But I guess maybe I just have so little memory of playing the original Final Fantasy VII that I wasn't even like waiting for that moment to come up. You know.
Yep, they're all very short segments in the original.
Sam, where are you?
I haven't played since we last talked.
Wow,
week. Chapter 14 or something. So you're catching up to me.
Wow.
I took a break so you can catch up.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for you, buddy. Cool, I did thanks. Recreate the entirety of Free Gold Watch in Animal Crossing.
Cool.
What?
Yeah.
How many pinball machines do you have in there?
About 63.
Wow. How much are they each? Like 10,000 bells at least?
You know what's lucky is that the pinball machines, I think, are $27.50, but the arcade machines are $65,000.
That's what it is. That's right.
So like, I could do like 5 pinball machines a day and add it all up. But the arcade machines took a lot. But there's fewer arcade machines at Free Gold Watch. But I was pretty impressed with the outcome. If you would go to Free Gold Watch's Instagram, they put up a video for their 14th anniversary. It's pretty cute. It looks really good.
I feel like $65,000 is way more expensive than even the most expensive arcade cabinet of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, those there's like these Star Wars sphere cabinets recently. Which was like, did you guys see those where you like sit down and it's like projecting on like the inside of a sphere? Yeah. Those are like $25,000, which is crazy.
If you take the economic value of a bell versus a real life dollar, you know, consider you can grow those things on trees. That's going to put the economy into turmoil. But yeah, second off, that reduces the value. So it's much cheaper, actually.
Are bells really more like yen?
I think a bell translates to a yen because it's like 100 bells for an apple.
I never thought about that.
That makes sense. I never tried to do the math on that.
But there's also just a boot that you can sell, so I wouldn't think about it too much.
Weed shells.
Yeah.
Coral. And some of those shells are worth a lot of bells.
Sea bass.
Did you guys see PETA's going after Animal Crossing?
Yeah, I heard that, but I didn't see it.
Well, is it an owl that runs the museum?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a beef with the owl and his like fish catching.
Oh, he hates bugs.
Okay, something like that.
Yeah.
My daughter's favorite thing on this earth right now is they play Animal Crossing with me, and Blathers the owl, who runs the museum, sleeps during the day. He's an owl. He's nocturnal. And they always want me to go into the museum and wake him up because he gets this shocked. He goes, bong, and then his eyes get really big.
He goes, who? Who?
Do you have that reaction emoji for your avatar?
That's a good question. I don't
your
know.
Villager.
But they laugh and laugh and laugh and always want me to go wake up the owl.
You should do it with him. Take a screenshot. They'll love it.
The other really good reaction, one of my favorites ever, is when you wake up Gulliver finally and he looks at his phone. And when he finds out his phone is broken, he says, oh my gosh. And it goes, dong.
That's one of my least favorite things because it takes 5 tries just to wake him up. And then 15 lines of dialogue. I'm slowly moving into Damon's camp now.
This is what happens when you book what you've been playing.
So, Sam, you've been playing Animal Crossing instead of Final Fantasy.
Yeah, I got sucked back in.
Okay.
You know, a bunch of friends just got it, too, because Switches are kind of coming back in stock and they're around. Mm. So, like, that's been funny. I'm like, come to my town. I'm like, your town's all tents. No.
Yeah. You live in a shanty town. Like.
And, Tina, you already beat Final Fantasy VII. So, have you been playing anything else?
No, nothing. Not even Animal Crossing. I'm playing the game of life, not the board game. Although the board game is good.
That's the least exciting game.
I found that board game is fun to take out and put down on the ground and look at, and then look at all the stuff in it. But then it's not fun to play. Yeah, I love everything about life.
After hour one, I love life. Actually, like that's a great board game. They had like a PC version many years ago that I was obsessed with for a while. It was pretty true to its original, so it's pretty good.
It's hardcore.
I recommend it.
And then Justin, you still Picrossing?
Yeah, but I was gonna talk about something else. I am playing Final Fantasy 13.
Yeah, whoa!
Twist. No, we talked about it on the show. I followed through on, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago on Scoop. I talked about how some people are criticizing Final Fantasy VII for how linear it was, but that appealed to me because it's more of a chill game, which just sort of tells you where to go next and what to do next. And that made me think of 13. that's what everybody hated about that game. And two things. One, it's completely not an exaggeration. It is literally like walk in a straight line, fight, and then the fight, I usually just select auto battle, and then a cutscene. And like that's been like the first 6 hours of that game. So it's like all the criticism of 13 is totally fair. But for me, like I'm literally playing the game lying down. Like it's super chill, and like they're setting up this mystery that I'm like pretty invested in, and the game's still really, really beautiful on my PC in 2020. And you know, the music's really good. So it's like if you treat it a little bit more of like a visual novel, or just like I'm gonna relax and just like go on this adventure that the game takes me on, like I'm really enjoying it, but it is a little bit indefensible in its design for sure.
Have you been spending all of your multitasking time then? Eating snacks with the other hand?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I got to figure out if I can advance the dialogue with the left trigger.
Yeah. Or the D pad. I didn't know that game was on PC though.
It's on PC and the port's not very good. Like I had to do some, you know, PC gaming trickery to get it running, but it you know, up-reses to HD just sort of like automatically. So the game looks really pretty and beautiful.
Hmm. Lightning is a cool character.
Yeah.
Like Lightning.
Yeah. The rest of the party kind of sucks. Saz is cool. I'll report back more later.
Okay, good. In addition to Final Fantasy VII, I've been playing another game that I'm actually much more excited about. It is amazing. I have found a truly amazing Super Damon game. It is called The Eternal Castle. It was out on PC, I think, last year. Now it's on Switch. And I'm going to show you guys a trailer, because what's so cool about this game is what it looks like. It has the coolest art style I've seen in a long time.
You said it's PC and Switch?
Yep.
Awesome.
It was called The Eternal Castle. So this is... it, and what it is, it's a cinematic platformer like Out of This World or Flashback or Prince of Persia. And this is what it looks like. This is what the whole game looks like. And it has like all these like eerie horror sections. It's awesome. I just love the look of this game. I think the whole playthrough only takes like 90 minutes. So I actually want to have it just as like a movie that I can like put on and watch sometimes because it looks so cool.
Is it a point and click type game?
No. It's like a cinematic platformer. You move through these environments left and right. There's some combat, this really basic combat, and then some light puzzle solving, and you can affect the environment. But the real draw, I feel, is just like how cool the game looks.
Yeah. Is there a run button?
Oh. Whoa.
There is a run and a walk. Awesome. I know. There's a run and a walk button and a crouch button.
What's a walk button?
Well, you have like a medium gait that's like normal run, and then there's a slow walk button, and then there's a fast run button.
Okay.
It's like, you know, pushing all the way forward on the thumbstick.
Yeah, if you don't want to move too fast, if you want to, there's a spooky haunted house section of the game.
Yeah.
If you're just trying to take it in your environment, you know, take life at a slow pace.
I've never heard of a walk button before.
You know what needed a walk button? It was Red Dead Redemption 2.
It needed a walk button?
Yeah, yes.
Because it has a walk button.
Because there's like...
I think there were six walk buttons.
I highly recommend The Eternal Castle to two groups of people. Group A would be people that like cinematic platformers like Out of This World, Flashback, Prince of Persia, Inside, Limbo. Group two, people that can appreciate a game purely for its cool art style.
Added Inside and Limbo in there. Nobody likes those games anymore. They're so hard to play.
I still like those games.
What about group three, people who like horror?
Yeah.
Except there's only one. There's like four different worlds, and only one of them is a horror world. Mm. So it's not a horror game all the way through.
Yeah. Okay. And group four, just Damons.
Just Damons. 10 out of 10 Damons are going to really get a kick out of this game. And finally, I want to note, I'm really happy that Panel de Pon is on Switch now through the Nintendo Online Service.
Yeah, I gotta play it.
Yeah.
That's Tetris super Attack. But
it's Tetris. Yeah.
Without Yoshi or Tetris.
Yep. The menus are in Japanese, but it's pretty easy to, you know, maneuver them, get into a single player game. I think what I really like is the versus mode, because that's where you go and play against specific characters, like moving through levels.
The versus when you're playing another person is really frustrating for that other person if they don't know that game, because it's like, you know,
so
you have to learn each puzzle. And that one has this very specific technique by which you just screw over the other person. And if one person knows that, it's not fun to play with them.
No, Panel de Pon and Tetris Attack are amazing. Some of the best puzzle games ever made, but they're not intuitive and obvious in the way that, like, you know, I don't know, like Tetris is or like Columns is. It's definitely a skill that you have to learn.
They're more intuitive than Wario's Woods. That game makes zero sense.
That's true.
I played for many, many years. I played a MMO called Puzzle Pirates, where it was a bunch of people that got together and crewed a pirate ship. And each station on the ship was a different puzzle minigame. So if you ran the bilge station, like keeping the ship afloat and stopping it from flooding, you were basically playing like Bejeweled.
And is there a cat appearance about to happen?
Is there a what now?
Yeah, I tried to get her to.
Okay. I sensed a cat off camera for a little bit there.
The combat in Puzzle Pirates was paneled upon. It was Tetris attack, and so it was sword fighting, and you would have to drop the swords down and get big combos and eliminate your foes. It was the best.
It's also the same game as Pokemon Puzzle League.
Yep.
On handhelds.
Pokemon Puzzle League was on Nintendo 64.
Well, it's also on Game Boy Color. That's where I know it from, at least.
Yeah.
Okay, let's check in with the listeners.
Hi.
Hey, listeners.
Listeners, remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@ign.com, just like Scott Langley and Lacey Washington did. It says, Dear Goose Campers, with the current COVID situation hindering the recording of audio and motion capture for new games, do you think we will see studios change course to develop even more remasters than what we've been seeing lately? That's interesting to think that developers or publishers would pivot into remastering more games if they can't, if their current, you know, games they're working on get delayed.
First of all, the cat's here now, so.
Yeah, okay. I made it happen.
Just so you know. There's a little cat face. So when you first were bringing up this topic, I was thinking like, oh, why would it be any easier, you know, remotely to make a remaster than anything? But I was thinking of like the full remakes where they really up-res everything and they do a bunch of work. But like a lot of games just need a fresh coat of paint and be thrown in a collection with others. So
yeah,
I'm sure those are easier because those are basically ports.
Well, and like go ahead, Tina.
Tony Hawk.
Mm-hmm. That's a big remake.
Yeah, but if you know, they talked a lot about how they actually used motion capture to make sure that they're creating like realistic, you know, characters and whatnot, and like really adding a good visual style that's realistic. And like mocap is going to be the thing that's really hard to do right now.
You can't do that, right?
Exactly. So it depends. Like if people want a really polished remaster that uses like current technology and design mechanisms, like it might still be the same scenarios as any other game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then you do have to, like, the people are beating down EA's door for a Mass Effect, you know, trilogy remaster, you know, among other things. Yep. And they, you know, they're not, for whatever reason, they're not delivering it. You know, they clearly have other plans in mind. But maybe this will force them to change their tune.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Yeah, EA is sitting on a lot. I would love a Dead Space remaster.
If you're audio only, you probably need to watch the episode on YouTube this week.
If you like that.
I'd love a Dead Space remaster. I'd love Burnout's remaster of any of those original games. If Capcom wanted to remaster Beautiful Joe 1 and 2, I would totally play those again. We just got Saints Row the 3rd remastered, and it actually kind of sounds like that's kind of a cheap remaster based on McCaffrey's review. So yeah, and I don't know, that one was planned already before the pandemic, but I could definitely see publishers looking at their older IPs, thinking about what could we get out the door.
Well, and that was tied to the Nintendo rumor that I think we talked about last week, where there could be Mario remasters this year, right?
That's true.
That would be a top of my list. Would be like a really cool widescreen, you know, high res Mario 64. I would play through it start to finish right away.
Yeah,
same with Sunshine. Anything.
There's a widescreen mod for Mario 64 out there now. I don't know if you've seen the videos.
PC versions are amazing.
Yeah.
But it's not it's a PC port. So different than like, you know, emulation.
Sure.
It's a bummer to think about games being delayed as a result of this. Of course, it's inevitable. We talked last week about how, you know, like orchestras can't get together to record orchestral scores and, you know, motion capture and like game programming and art to like varying degrees are like, you know, can be done in work from home offices. But I don't know. It's sad. It's like there's not this immediate impact like there is, you know, like filming of television and movies, which shut down. Right. Like, but the games industry is going to have this sort of delay knock-on effect. So yeah, maybe we'll start to feel that more in 2021. Bummer.
I think likely we'll start to see more of a surge in, like, you know, independently made games and maybe more of a focus on them because they're doing more of that like barrage style development anyway, where they already have their rigs at home. They don't need to think about like, how do I upgrade, you know, my work setup at home? Do I go into the office? Do I get it shipped from there? Like, how does that stuff operate? And they're a smaller scale team, so the collaboration was probably done over the internet anyway. Like a couple of my game developer friends that are part of a smaller group, like an independently formed group, it's just they've noticed that the work from home setup is beneficial as opposed to for like a AAA scale level game where they are doing things like mocap and bringing in actors to be right next to one another for this stuff is more difficult to pull off that level of production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually talked to a friend of mine who works at a AAA studio, and she was talking about how they're doing mocap in a way where they book the person, and this is in another country, goes to the studio, and then the studio, you know, people are on the other side of glass and stuff either, if there's just one person, and they're able to actually start working through it. It's just like, it's slower and stuff like that. But like, that's like to keep a major game on schedule. And I thought that was interesting that they worked it out. I don't think most of the United States is ready for that yet, but maybe, you know, European countries and Canada and stuff like that are starting to work it out.
Yeah, I heard that's what they're doing with symphonies too. They have like the first chair flute come in by themselves and just record their part, and then the second chair flute comes in and records their part. That was just a joke. No one's.
Yeah, you can't do that. There's not a big demand for symphony recordings right now either. I just want to point that out. It's not like everybody's like, "When is the new version of Beethoven's Fifth coming out?"
No. Video games use symphonic orchestras all the time.
Yeah, that's true. I think they can use like cool MIDI stuff.
Okay, moving on. This is Brian from Austin, Texas. And he wants to know if we could send one modern game back in time for your childhood self to play, what would it be?
This is a really good question. I thought about it a lot.
It kept you up all night?
It did. I thought about it last night a lot. I have a lot of answers to this. One's first I started with like games I would have liked as a kid, because I really liked Final Fantasy 1, and then I liked Final Fantasy 2, which we call 4 now a lot. Those are like probably my favorite games when I was a kid. But before that, I liked Super Mario Brothers. So I think about that. But then I thought, you know, I got really robbed of is Minecraft. Everybody I know grew up with Minecraft and loves it. And if I would have had that as a kid, like Legos are my favorite thing. And by the time Minecraft came out, I was like, this is not interesting for me. But if as a kid, I would have loved it. And my nephew's playing it now, and I talked to him about it, and I'm like, man, this is like his like favorite thing, and it's like so fun for him. And I'm like, I would have loved this.
That's cool.
Would not have expected that answer.
Yeah.
But then again, like, I don't like a lot of the games I played as a kid now, so maybe I would have grown up and moved past Minecraft. I mean, that's fine, right? It's just I know I would have liked it as a kid.
I'm on a similar trajectory and did not stay up all night thinking about it. So this is very like cursory level of thought that I put into this. But I was thinking about the same line of thought of what did I like as a kid? What did I like spending my time doing? And it'd be, you know, an immediate come home from school, run downstairs, you know, can't wait to play, pick up from my save spot again. And like something like Red Dead 2, especially of the fidelity of today back then, would have blown my mind. Yeah. And the fact that there was so much, like I had more time back then. So for Red Dead 2, what was it, 2018 that it came out? I burned through that game in a week, and it's because we have to, you know, do work on that kind of stuff. I hosted our spoiler cast for it, so I was kind of under a certain level of a deadline. But if I were in high school, let's say, and able to run downstairs to my basement and pick up on my save, I think that would have been the thing that would have carried me through like weeks of enjoyment. And I would have probably spent more time discovering more side quests and like more NPCs and more of these random events and whatever else than I did in the 1 week that I burned through that game.
Yeah,
probably I would have also played RDO too, because I never played that.
Oh yeah, well, yeah.
Briefly, but yeah.
That's a really good point. Anything with an online component, like I would have played the crap out of as a kid, even though that didn't even exist when I was a kid. And like now, like Fortnite is a good example of that. I mean, like that's like a big zeitgeisty game that like every kid knows. And like there weren't games like that outside of Super Mario Brothers when we were kids. And yeah, Super Mario Brothers is great, but.
But especially something like, you know, a World of Warcraft online kind of multiplayer game where there's so much to explore and like actual communities to partake in and random events and whatnot. So the same thing for RDO, like I probably would have spent so much time in it, but it's something that I can't appreciate as much because I have limited time and I've got to go from one game rapidly to the next.
Mm-hmm. For Red Dead, we would have learned a lot about life.
Yeah.
But little kids play these games. Like, seriously, little kids are playing Grand Theft Auto, which I think is another level past Red Dead, even.
Yeah.
And they're learning the ways of the world.
Yeah, it would have also been kind of prophetic because a personal information moment. I actually had tuberculosis. People still get that these days. And it's, I think, like my doctor told me, 1 in 3 Americans do. And you have antibiotics now, and it takes 9 months of brutal antibiotics. But I think if I played that game and seen I'm trying not to say too much, but if I saw the existence of that disease play out in that game, it might have terrified the shit out of me following that.
Yeah. That was a really good spoiler workaround. Like 10 out of 10.
I tried.
Was really good.
Just like the game.
Yeah.
Spoiler ground.
Justin, how about you?
Yeah, my answer is similar to Tina's, where like I was trying to think about games that would have blown my little mind as a child. So like, something like God of War from 2018 popped into mind. Like if you were to send that game back in time, it would just feel like a miracle that shouldn't exist. Breath of the Wild was another one I thought about. But then I had another thought of what the question was phrased as: you can send one game back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if you were to send Breath of the Wild back to me when I was like 8, it would kind of ruin video games.
Well, there's that like, too, yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't want to play Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, like Twilight Princess. Like, oh, get out of here with these. So there's an argument that like maybe it's like a monkey's paw wish situation where you actually can kind of ruin video games for yourself if you're not careful.
Unless it was inspirational to other developers at the time, and actually it just evolved the trajectory of design work people did, and we would have been in a very different place in 2020. Yeah. Imagine the Zelda game that would have come out in 2020 were Breath of the Wild to come out when you were a kid.
Yeah. Now we're in like Back to the Future. Like, oh, yeah. I guess you're not ready for this yet.
If Breath of the Wild was sent back to me as a kid, I'd be like, there's no way there's a game on this thing.
I thought I wouldn't send back anything with dual analog sticks, cause I wouldn't be able to play it.
Yeah. We had to learn those like progressively, but now kids like, are even past that. They have to learn them anyway, progress, like because they just only use touch screens. Yeah. So like dual analog is always going to be confusing. There's this one generation that was like kind of like born into it. Pretty funny.
Yeah. So I would send back like a modern version of games I was playing back then. That would still be super impressive to me. I'd send back like Dead Cells or Inside or Spelunky, something 2D, but that still, is several measures beyond what an NES could have provided me and still would have been amazing. You know, more impressive than even what a Super Nintendo could do.
Yeah, yeah. I think any of the Mario games, because we grew up playing Mario games, would be cool because they're always just an evolution. And even Mario Odyssey, like, I could have figured that out. It's not that far off of Mario 3, which is a game I played, like Tina's saying, for probably 2 years.
But also then you wouldn't appreciate certain elements, because I think you look at Mario Odyssey and there's like little references, like ways that you can see it evolve. So like there's a different level of appreciation having lived through the entirety of that franchise.
Mm-hmm. But I could have still named all the Koopa Kids.
Naming, like, if you sent back a game from the future that had references to old Mario games, but those old Mario games were still newer than what you had sent back in the past, you'd be like, why is Mario wearing these vacation clothes? What's Flood?
Would people even like What the Golf if we played it when we were kids?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, probably not.
It would just be confusing.
Yeah, like, why do the levels keep changing?
All right, this is Wes from North Carolina. He says, hello, Games Cooped Up crew. I have a question about music in games. Are there any songs that immediately make you think about a specific game or a gaming-related moment in your life? When I was a kid, my older sister and I shared a playroom. The agreement was I could use the TV to play Super Nintendo if I muted the sound, and she could use her boombox to listen to music. Mm-hmm. Looking back, this makes me sad because I didn't understand the importance or impact of soundtracks in games. But that being said, I still can't hear certain NSYNC songs without thinking of Donkey Kong Country 2.
Oh, man. Yeah, I didn't think that was the way this question was going to go. But I absolutely, when you're a kid and you first start listening to pop music or the radio, which is, not around anymore. But if kids, that was like what a Spotify was back in the day. I used to play Sonic the Hedgehog 3 and listen to the radio. That was like when I was first watching MTV and stuff. And like every song, like 90s song from that time, like that's not rock and roll, because it's been like pop music. I can't even name artists now. Like, but it would be, whenever I hear that stuff, I always think of Sonic. Just Genesis and pop music from 1992.
So early 90s pop music.
Yeah.
But what, I thought you were going to go with Music Factory?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. I thought you were going to go with like songs that are in games that make you think of games. So like when I think of like, I think it's Flock of Seagulls, I Ran So Far Away. Yes. When I hear that, or like Gary Newman's Here in My Car, I just think of Vice City. Like, yeah. I think it was in the ads for that game.
Yeah, probably.
What does Freebird make you think of?
Can't think of a game that's in.
What do you mean? It's like,
like Rock Band.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the only kind of association I could think of where a song makes me think of a game, because I've never replaced the soundtrack or like had music in the background. Like I was trying to think about arcade experiences, but no like consistent song that would have created like made me develop. Yeah, It was, I guess I put that over and over.
Weezer and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and what else? I get that first Rock Band, man. Like all of the songs in Rock Band make me think of Rock Band for sure.
In Bloom from Nirvana.
In Bloom.
That's one of the first songs that was unlocked.
The easy ones you hear so much more than the others. That's why I think of that Weezer song.
Yeah, for sure.
Buddy Holly, I think it was something. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Say It Ain't So, probably.
Say It Ain't So. Jeez. There are some goofy ones, though. There's like a Highway Star was one. And like, I don't know that song outside of Rock Band.
Dude, well, the total number of songs that like ended up being available for Rock Band is just insane.
Yeah. Exactly what I was going to say. There's like hundreds of songs. They continued their licensing for years.
Songs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't they make that weird change though, where when Rock Band 1 became Rock Band 2, like you didn't really get any Rock Band 1 songs and it was like shitty. And then from there on out though, I think they were pretty good about keeping your library intact.
Yeah. I don't remember.
Well, they used to have weekly DLC where they're like five more songs available for Rock Band, and then they eventually just like opened it up and they're like, "Nah, we just have 5,000 songs now. But you know, buy what you want."
It's true. It's so crazy. Tina, Justin, any other sort of like music moments you relate with games?
I thought about it. My memory growing up is I was generally listening. Like, I didn't have the volume muted listening to pop music. Me and my friends listened to a lot of Andrew WK and playing like, you know, Super Smash Brothers Melee in high school for sure. But no, like I was generally appreciating the in-game sound.
Same here. I think it's the vice versa scenario where a game will remind me of one of its songs. Like I'll remember a specific song in accordance with it.
Hmm. Here's something weird. My first CD player was my Sega CD. And it has like a CD player mode. So you'd put music in, you know, music CD in, and then you would like on your television with your Genesis controller, select like play and pause and repeat and like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely associate like that era. Like that was the era where you'd get this ad, and this worked, where you could get like, you know, 10 CDs for 10 cents. Do you guys remember those?
Yeah.
Yeah. They had to cancel right away.
Yeah. Then you had to cancel, or they'd charge you $30 each month for a CD, but it worked, and you could do it for like the, whatever it was, BMG, and you could do it for like another one. And then like, you could do that. You get like 10, 12 free CDs all the time. And like, boy, like I remember like Nirvana's Nevermind and like early Pearl Jam stuff. Like that whole era was like my Sega CD played all that stuff. And I thought I definitely associate with that. It's just the Sega CD had terrible games. So I don't also associate, and you couldn't play them at the same time. So I don't associate it with the games, just the console.
Yeah. I have a remarkably similar, like, my very first CD player was a Sega CD, and my first two CDs were Bob Marley Legend and Green Day Dookie.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened to Dookie on through my TV speakers a lot.
I definitely listened to Dookie on my Sega CD as well. My friend Richie designed the cover art for that.
Oh,
cool.
That's a good cover art. And it's big. Yeah. It's really big.
Good album.
Yeah.
The only music sort of memory I have, because I also usually always listen to in-game music, but I went through a brief phase in high school. I guess it was a little angsty. And our second television in our house was in my parents' bedroom. And I would go in there and play Sega Genesis. I'd play Shining Force 1 and 2. And I'd turn off the lights and I'd listen to two albums, Tom Petty's Wildflowers and Live Through This by Hole.
Okay.
Whoa. And play Shining Force 1 and 2 in the dark and listen to those two albums.
Wildflowers has The Last Dance with Mary Jane on it, right? So that's your angsty song on that?
I don't know if it's actually on that album because it was part of.
Like Free Fallin' and stuff. I had that album too, but I thought when I got it, I got it as one of those 10 CDs for 10 cents, and I was like, I don't like this. But I don't think I ever owned a whole record, but like every song on those whole records was a single.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a great album. I think Last Chance Was Mary Jane was written just for his greatest hits album. Mm. I remember that correctly. Anyway.
I have one more that probably doesn't count, but so. I associate Left 4 Dead with Silence. Because I would have to keep it on. I think it came out when I was in like high school or something. So I'd be in my bedroom at like 2 a.m. playing this thing, and I needed it to be on mute so my parents wouldn't hear and see that I'd be playing in the middle of the night. Mm. I'd sometimes just have to like, you know, turn my TV off and pretend like I was sleeping the whole time.
They knew.
I'm sure they did.
That reminded me that I think the Portal song by Jonathan Coulton was probably the most popular piece of pop music ever from a video game. Like that was so huge. It was just everywhere.
The entire that was really soundtrack good. Is amazing.
Yeah, there's the other good music in Portal too. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, this is Jay from Buffalo, New York. It says, "Hey, Omega Cops. I was wondering what happened to Sega. Most companies stick with their IPs and keep pushing out sequels. As for Sega, it seems they barely make games anymore, and all their best IPs have been made by other developers like Sonic Mania, Panzer Dragoon, and Streets of Rage." Will Sega ever revisit classics like Sega Rally, Crazy Taxi, Jet Set Radio, Daytona USA, Virtua Fighter, House of the Dead, Sega Bass Fishing, Vector Man, Shinobi, Knights, and tons more? Thanks, guys. Listening to your show has made many, many miles of running fly by.
The Seaman disrespect will not stand. No, I do think about this a lot. You know, there's been other game developers, obviously, you know, Midway, Acclaim, you know, Konami, like the list goes on and on of developers that have fallen off and they're either gone or like a shell of their former selves. But like Sega really stands out to me because like they almost won. Like they did it for a while. They were at like the top of like the video game software and hardware pile, and like to see them sort of fall from grace and not be able to recapture that is like, you know, a major bummer. Like for as much as I make fun of Sonic the Hedgehog on this show, like I was a Genesis kid growing up. I was not a Super Nintendo kid. And so it's really crazy seeing how their two paths have diverged and where Nintendo is today and where Sega is today. No one would have guessed that in 1991.
Yeah.
When you look back at those like really early days of Sega and this, just 90 to 2000, you know, kind of pre-Dreamcast, they were really like, they were Sonic, they were marketing, and they were sports games. And that's why they're in like every single house. And the stuff that they had that was really interesting that Sega kids got into, like the RPGs and stuff like that, like those really never were popular. So like the sports games and the Sonic games and then their marketing campaign, like were all huge. And then the Dreamcast came out and that wasn't very popular, but the games were really good for it. And I didn't play any of those because their marketing was bad. Nobody wanted to play Sega anymore. And then everything just didn't work out for them. Like I've never played a Crazy Taxi game, but I hear they're good. But like, I don't know if that coming back is going to change the world. Like it's just like they had these like blip games.
Yeah.
They didn't survive. Sorry, Tina. They didn't survive the transition to 3D the way that Nintendo did. Like Nintendo found a way to continue keeping Mario and Zelda. Like they're really different. They're super different games in 3D than they were in 2D, but they made it work in a way that Sega's obviously making great 3D games now, but like Sonic didn't quite get there and they really stumbled around that transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like ultimately, I was going to say the same thing. Basically, it's just a business, you know. I think we see a lot of commentary online. It's like, why wouldn't they just do this? Like, this is clearly the easiest answer, you know, solution to all of their business problems, and it's as easy as just doing this remaster or like doing a sequel to this game. And there's just so many factors at play, like from marketing departments to maybe like, you know, creative disagreements amongst leads, you know, deals that are being struck with other companies. So it's just a myriad amount of things that can possibly go wrong or where they make different decisions that flop. Nintendo has been through their own floppy decisions, but they've managed to bounce back. So it's like you have to identify where you've had missteps and figure out like what strategies you're going to shift to from there. I think like the Wii U is a really big learning area for Nintendo, but the Switch was definitely born out of the Wii U. So they found success in failure, and that's the way you survive.
Yeah, Nintendo's internal studio is the best game development studio in the world, like up there with Rockstar and CD Projekt. Like there's just not that much out there that has such a good record. I think Nintendo's easily the best. And Sega never really developed that developer platform. That they made great games for their Dreamcast, and then when they said we're going to make games for everybody else, it's not like they really stood out as this big developer or really invested in that. I'm surprised by that. I don't know why that is. And there's not big creative names associated with Sega. That's kind of sad. I don't know why that is. It's weird.
You know, the names that were associated with them, you know, aren't there anymore. They, you know, that's they let the them problem. Leave. Or...
Yep. Yuji Naka, yeah. And stuff like that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So in 2004, Sega was taken over by Sammy. And then it was revealed that Sega had been operating at a loss for almost a decade. They hadn't made any money in almost a decade. So Sammy decided to focus more on the parts of the business that were actually making money, which is the arcade business. Sega operated arcades and then made arcade machines. And then around that same time,
well, it was an easy decision to make.
They lost their key talent, like Yuji Naka and Yu Suzuki. So it would literally be like Miyamoto leaving Nintendo, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I
imagine that I know a little bit about business. Like, I run a not crazy small part of IGN's business, and I've been around the world a little while. How do you run a business for a decade? How are they paying their bills? Like, literally, where does the money come from after 9 years of losses to, like, continue even having employees?
Because you made enough
crazy
money.
Generous burn rate. Yeah.
Yeah. You made enough money in the early 90s.
Yeah. Or, you know, they have loans from banks. Like, but yeah, it's still crazy.
It's actually just a Ponzi scheme.
And then I guess for like all these IP that Jay from Buffalo mentions, I guess I would just guess that, you know, they're not quite as strong or as beloved as you think they are. There's been a few crazy taxis after the Dreamcast, but I don't think they were well received. It's a free to play mobile game now. They released Jet Set Radio HD in 2012 to mixed reviews. House of the Dead is always more of an arcade game. There is a new arcade game released in 2018 that's in arcades.
Vector That's a game Man, that could have been reinvented as like a really cool survival horror series, or like
or
it VR. Never got updated.
I don't think there's a VR version of it yet, even though that seems to make sense. Vector Man was only ever on the Sega Genesis, you know, it never went beyond that, and it was sort of it was impressive at the time. It was impressive for its animation. Yeah. So I don't know, and then it's like Shinobi. They made a 3D Shinobi game for Nintendo 3DS.
Yeah.
But
I never thought ninja games would come back in any other way than like Ninja Gaiden, but like there's an era of Dark Souls-y ninja games now, which people really like.
So yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, it's very easy to play armchair developer, like Tina said. But
sure.
Like, clearly, if you would have just done this, but like, there's no denying that like some of that IP and some of those franchises have been like a little bit mismanaged, or there's missed opportunities there to have reinvented them in the modern era.
We should also note, I think Sega's doing much better today than it has in a long time, thanks to Yakuza and the Sonic the Hedgehog movie was well received.
They own, what do you call it? The Creative Assembly? Is that right? The Total War games are all them.
Oh,
so,
yeah. And then the Two Point Hospital developer they actually bought. And
Did you guys see the Sonic movie?
I didn't see it, no.
Nobody's
seen
it?
I think people liked it. I think people liked it.
Are we required to watch that for GameScoop?
You're required to not watch it. Oh, if you ever watch it, you're not allowed to be on.
You're off the show.
Damon, I'm glad you brought that up though, because you know, we've been talking about them a little bit in like, you know, almost postmortem terms, but like Sega, like Yakuza's amazing and it's one of my favorite things. They've been around since before this generation, but the resurgence and popularity of Yakuza is like one of the stories of this generation that I, you know, is sort of tickled me and pleased me the most. And although Total War isn't my thing, like I know that those games are really beloved and continue to be incredibly popular on the PC. So,
and also Streets of Rage 4 is really, really good. And they were smart enough to just let this other studio who had a lot of love for the franchise make that sequel. And it turned out great. So.
Well, and Sonic Mania was similar, right? Where like they took fans making a Sonic fan game, you know, and turned it into something official. Like, So
pretty, Sega's doing
savvy moves.
Sega's doing much better than like Konami, which is literally just sitting on beloved IP that they're not doing anything with. One more email to get through before we get to Video Game 20 questions. This is from Tom, and Tom has a simple but important question. What made you fall in love with video games?
It's a big question, Damon.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you asked that kind of later on, but I have to think about it a little bit. I mean, I think we were kind of lucky to be in a place in our generation. We have never not had video games. Like there was just not really an option. Like they were just around, and so they were just a thing. Like movies or TV. Yeah. Was it different for you?
Yeah, when you have strict as hell parents or like against screens and whatever else, and your best access to it is the you know, begrudging road trips you take to Boston, where at least your cousin has a bunch of games where they barely let you play because it's all the, you know, the older cousins and brothers that are occupying the controller time. But still, you can fall in love with games in this way.
How did you fall in love with them?
Couple different moments, and a lot of it was like over the shoulder of my brothers and cousins playing, but I remember like specific elements. I've talked about GoldenEye on GameScoop before. That they actually let me play because there's more, you know, controllers, there's more people that you can play with, and I got really good at it. And I think you know, being able to put my brothers in their places on a game where they were just sort of like inherently think that they would be better at it than I was something that made me really fall in love with that particular game. It's also just like a bonding experience with everybody. And then I remember watching my brother play Ragnarok, and I thought it was so magical. I'm rewatching Lord of the Rings, and I'm thinking the same thing about just the magic that it sort of instills in you. There's literal magic in Ragnarok, but it was like this big open world, and it seemed like this really beautiful environment, and I just really wanted to live in it. I think that escapism is... Ragnarok was maybe one of the first moments where I felt like a draw to that level of escapism. And then Counter-Strike, you know, original Counter-Strike, I played a lot of when I was able to, and just being really competitive and being really good at that game and feeling good about that also made me fall in love with it.
That's cool. My parents were not strict, but they did not like video games, and I didn't have any myself. So I went to my cousin's house in St. Louis when I was a little kid. And they had Nintendo, which I'd never heard of before. And they had Excitebike, Castlevania, and Super Mario Brothers, which are really good games to be introduced to.
Yeah.
And I remember Castlevania especially just being like, this is, you know, it was just the interactivity and stuff was amazing. But that's not my earliest game memories. I really wanted a Nintendo after that for sure. And I fell in love with it. My earliest was Zork and sitting at which is a text-based adventure game. And, you know, having, you know, no... reading and writing skills and, you know, being in front of a really primitive early computer with a friend, and in this case, also my cousin, I would just spend hours like playing with that. And that's the earliest interactive thing I remember. And so that drew me in because it was a story and because it was interactive and all these other ways that were not Nintendo. Like, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Justin, how about you?
Well, it's interesting. Like, video games have never not been a part of my life. I think we got the NES when I was 5, and although it was a family gift, like, it was mostly a gift for Justin. And so, you know, Mario 1, 2, and 3, all the NES games, all the SNES and Genesis games, I've never, ever not been with games. But I think the turning point for me was the launch of the Nintendo 64 and Mario 64. That was the very first time I remember two things happening. One, you know, being a gamer and playing games formed a part of my core identity at around that age. I was 12 or 13. So before that, it was like I played video games, but didn't give a lot of thought of like, what kind of person do I want to be? How do I want to outwardly, like, you're making choices in middle school about, like, you know, what kind of person you're going to be. And it's the very first time I remember getting online and thinking about games and talking about them and being involved with that hobby outside of playing them. I don't ever remember, like, I visited N64.com and Nintendo.com and posted on the message boards. And, you know, 12-year-old me was like arguing with people about Mario and Turok the Dinosaur Hunter. And that was sort of a new take on, you know, like, you think about all the people that like watch Twitch now, but don't play a game themselves, but they're still gamers. It's still like a core part of their culture, right? And like, that was the turning point for me, was around the launch of Mario 64 and thinking about that game all the time when I wasn't playing it. That was new.
Yeah, for sure. yeah, I don't ever remember a time. I don't remember not loving video games. Like Sam was alluding to, growing up in the early 80s, arcade machines were everywhere. They're in the they're at the grocery store. They're at the convenience store, they're at the gas station, they're at the pizza parlor, they're at the burger joint. They're just literally everywhere. And when you're out and about, that's how parents would like keep their kids entertained, give them a few quarters to go play Time Pilot or Defender or Miss Pac-Man or whatever. Handing them what? Your phone?
Handing them your phone.
It's the early 80s equivalent of handing your kid your phone. And the arcade machines are just like perfectly designed to capture the attention of children. They have these flashing lights and laser sounds are coming out of them. And there's this beautiful art on the side of aliens attacking Earth, or a giant like Arnold Schwarzenegger commando dude firing a giant machine gun into a jungle. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. This is what I want to be standing in front of this arcade cabinet forever looking at this. This is perfect for me. I love it. I love it. I love it. That's just like, that was my growing up. And like, I've never like not had that love in my life. Mm-hmm.
I have a very cute picture of my daughters. We went to sort of a family-friendly tavern that has like a wall of arcade machines. So the adults are sitting there sort of sharing a drink. And then, you know, we're keeping an eye on our kids. And they're all, they had one stool and they'd somehow piled like four or five kids on this single stool to like look up and like, you know, look at whatever. I think it was like Killer Queen or, you know, some arcade machine. And I'm like, that was me. That was me 30 years ago, you know, when I was five. And we have a really cute picture of them all huddled around that screen. And I think certain experiences like that are pretty universal, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I should also mention, like, I loved Nintendo Power and EGM growing up. When 2000 came around and I started reading IGN, I was super into games in a different way. I was into who's making what, what's coming out. I got really excited about what was coming out for GameCube, and yeah. I was really into reviews. And like, that's where like my fandom really changed. I wasn't just like a kid that liked video games like all my friends did. It became like, I like really started connecting with the culture of video games. And then when Kotaku and Joystick came around later, I read them, like I read every article on those sites, like just cover to cover basically for years. And I like just became completely obsessed, and I really, really liked the coverage of games. Then I got into them that way too. So I think that was like a next level moment. You know, I had a similar Mario 64 one like Justin did too. And then, and so like, you know, as things kind of notched up, and that's when I decided like, I want to work in this industry too.
Yeah, yeah, same. You can actually draw a direct line. Like I mentioned, I posted on the Nintendo.com forums, or you know, maybe even early IGN boards back then. And like that was when I was just starting to discuss video games. And I was, you know, 12 or 13. And I was writing for fan sites, like Nintendo fan sites, you know, Nintendojo and places like that, 3 years later, like by the time I was like 16. And like there's a direct line, like a direct line between that and the work I'm doing now. Because I wrote for free, you know, as a fan. And then started getting, you know, small freelance gigs as high school, you know, as I was still in high school and winding into college. And like, it's not like I'm older now, but like, there's no, it's a straight direct continuity from like, from playing Mario 64 to where I am today.
Mm-hmm. I think there's like definitely a second phase of life to all of this where, you know, we got into the industry and fell in love with it in a different way. And I started writing about video games when I was in college. And my first, like, you know, I'd been to E3 and done interviews and whatever else, but I was kind of like, you know, learning the ropes and being given the assignments no one else wanted because I was new. And everyone else had like a little bit more experience than I did. But my first major preview and my major interviews were for Dragon Age Origin. And I had flown to Edmonton, interviewed the founders. And it was just this like, you know, major starstruck moment. And also the kind of opportunity for me where I realized like there are other professionals in this industry. You know, at the time I was young, so I'm scratching it up to quote air quote professionals. But you could talk to them about games on a level that I'd always wanted to. Mm-hmm. Like I want to dissect like this boss level, or I want to talk about this storyline moment. And I didn't really like grow up with people who, aside from my brothers, who were interested in talking about games on that level. So when I went to this week long preview event, it just was it opened an entirely different world to me, to this community where like I could speak about things on a level that people not only understood, but reciprocated and added to. And it turned into like a genuine conversation. I was like, yep, this is what I'm going to be doing, I think.
That's really cool.
You know, before I was in the industry or anything like that, I listened to GameScoop like before I ever worked at IGN or anything like that. That's how long ago GameScoop started.
How far you've come.
Really cool. And of course, I read Tina's bylines all the time in Kotaku.
Yeah,
all the time. Cool. Like I know the article. Like sometimes something comes up and we're talking. I'm like, yeah, I remember the article you wrote about that. It's really funny.
Really, I had a moment. Like I read EGM was like my magazine growing up, and it was, you know, it was Dan Hsu and John Davison. John Davison. Now, you know, we work together every day with an IGN. He works here now. And I, you know, Dan Hsu and I aren't like close friends, but we know each other socially and like have a friendly relationship. And that completely, like, I still can't believe it. It's still unbelievable to me that like that's where we're at in 2020 now.
I know. That's like the first time I met K Casamassina. Matt Casamassina.
Yeah, same.
Yep. Wow. I can't believe I'm meeting you. I can't believe I work with you. Jeez.
Yeah. I snuck into an E3 party and met all those guys 1 year.
So crazy. Tom's personal anecdote about falling in love with video games says, even though it hasn't aged very well, Assassin's Creed 3, because it sparked my interest in history, and I am now studying to be a history teacher.
Oh, cool.
And that brings us to Video Game 20 Questions. Our suggestion this week is from, I think it's someone we got an email from, Brian from Austin, Texas. He's the one that asked about sending one modern game back in time. How do you got this?
What are people playing there, Tina?
Who knows? I haven't seen a human being in many months.
Oh, because it's been Austin, Texas. That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, a hometown boy for Tina, let the questioning begin.
Does this game have to do with cowboys?
No.
Define you cowboys. Get
it. Yeah.
They wear hats and boots.
That's stupid.
Aren't restaurants open? Can't you go eat at a restaurant right now, Tina?
Yeah, restaurants are open at 25% capacity. And if you've been in one longer than 10 minutes, they take like a trail of record information from you so that they can trace any kind of developments of the disease. So
you eat really fast.
Yeah. Or you just sit there and get everything documented.
Finish in 9 minutes, like, suckers.
Yeah, bars are open too.
Oh my gosh. Okay. No, it does not have to do with cowboys.
I think you should still stay home, everybody. That's my advice to you.
All right.
Post-2000 game?
This was released after 2000, yes.
Okay.
That's what I was going to ask. Is this on the Nintendo Switch?
I love this one.
Yeah. Yes, it's on the Nintendo Switch.
I don't think it actually helps us, but it is something that, like, I think of now. Like, because it just narrows the library to, what is it, 900 games?
Well, yeah. I think it's totally helpful because the Switch, like, it can't be, like, a really graphically nutso game. Like, yeah, so it helps me.
Mm. Was it originally on Switch?
Yes.
What? All right, let's get, we got this.
Is it, can you hear my cat? Come here, kitty.
Yeah. Is it ARMS?
No, you can't do that.
Is this an indie game?
Are there arms in this game?
Is this an indie game? No, this is not an indie game. That's fine.
It's arms.
I'm impressed with Damon's ability to, like, parse out our goof questions from our real questions.
I know. Usually he has to say, is this your final question?
Is this a first party game?
Yes.
Ooh. Wait, so that means it's a Nintendo game.
Can you get this in single digits?
Oh boy.
Does this game have Mario characters in it?
No.
It could be ARMS.
Go ahead, Justin.
Was this game a new IP that made its debut on the Switch?
Yes.
I was going to say, is it part of like a well-recognized Nintendo franchise?
Do you got big stretchy arms?
Have we mentioned this game yet?
Have you mentioned this game yet? No.
Splatoon 2? Yeah. So Splatoon 1 was Wii U?
Was it? It's an IP new to Switch, though, so it's not Splatoon. Is that what that was a yes to IP new to Switch. So...
I really wanted it to be
Splatoon 1 was on Wii U. I know, that would have been great. It could be, you know, the snipper clips.
Mm.
But yeah, there's other new Switch games.
Yeah, there's not that much. Like, I mean, it could be 1-2 Switch.
Mm-hmm.
Was this game released for 60? Okay, was this a launch game?
A launch game, I ask.
No, not a launch game. That's so 10.
It's not Snipper Clips or 1-2 Switch.
It could be the ring game you put between your legs.
Could be Ring Fit. Why did you phrase it that way?
I don't know the name of it. What do you do with the ring?
It's true. Well, you do other things.
Yeah, you also
use your arms for it. So
you
arms
do?
Question could work.
Yeah, it's mostly arms, probably.
Look, it's not arms.
It's the first time we've ever got a flat out no.
Does this game use a wacky peripheral?
Yes.
Is it a fitness game?
Yes.
Wait, but I know it's Ring Fit, but there's the boxing one, right?
What's the boxing one?
I don't know. Maybe that one doesn't use a peripheral.
Is this Ring Fit Adventure?
Yes, Ring Fit Adventure. 13 questions.
Are you sure you don't just put that? I think the hands thing is cheating, right? It's like on the power pad. When you get on the power pad, you hit it. It's cheating.
Justin has played this for like 50 hours.
maybe he's cheating.
Plus B, no, that's A. Plus B, it's actually a Pilates ring, which I've done Pilates for very many years. You do put it between your legs often, but it's very frequently like an arm specific. You do exercise
one of the Joy-Con straps into the they call it the ring con, and then the other one straps to your leg, and so it's actually very clever. The one strapped to your leg knows if you're jogging in place, and then you're pushing and pulling the ring con to do, you know, shoot bows and arrows and do a bunch of crazy stuff.
It's very based on resistance training.
Yeah. And my daughter plays it every day now because it's sad. She can't get outside to play very much. So
is she just like really buff now?
She's a really buff 5-year-old.
She's a buff baby.
Do the rings break?
That's an Adventure Time reference.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
No, they're made for that, Sam.
Okay.
They're made for putting between your legs.
I think somebody at our work broke one.
Hmm. Only if you're a buff baby do you break them.
No. Kitty.
Yeah. Justin's gone through like 50.
Well, nicely job, everybody. Thank you for the suggestion, Brian from Austin, Texas. That is all the scoops we have for you this week. Everyone here in the good old US of A has a holiday weekend. We're going to be off tomorrow and Monday, but we will be back next Thursday with more game scoops. If you are in the United States, hopefully you have an enjoyable and relaxing holiday weekend. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Tina. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Borba, behind the scenes. Thank you to Lion for making such an exciting cameo.
Cameo somewhere in the back.
My name is Damon. This is IGN Game Scoop. And we're out. No one said anything about my hat this whole time.
I thought it just said cops. Super powerful evil. Super powerful robot evil. Super powerful robot evil. Super powerful robot evil. Super powerful. Evil robot. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out the Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for Dungeon Masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.